So, welcome to Root Week 5. We spent 2 weeks introduction. We're now on our third week of discussing Chapter 1, and odds are that next week we will also be discussing Chapter 1, and then hopefully that'll be that. I mean, Chapter 1 is where everything happens. After that, it does move a lot faster. So, what we've been talking about, we talked about this all last time, and even a little bit the time before, is the question of what exactly Elimelech's family did wrong. What was the problem with their conduct? The story clearly believes that they've done stuff wrong. The description of leaving Israel, Elimelech dies, Mahlon and Kilion marrying Moabite women, and then they die, really is presented that way. Naomi describes it that way. And we showed how rabbinic commentary builds along those lines. So our first approach was that what they did wrong was leaving the land of Israel. Just the fact that they left the land. No overtones about abandoning people in a famine, just leaving the land of Israel itself was problematic. We gave a little bit of a discussion, not much, about why that would be wrong. We talked about the value of living in Israel in terms of the mitzvot, as well as the overall spiritual benefits to living there. And what we said was that that sin would really be Elimelech's sin primarily. We said most commentators assume it's Elimelech's decision to move and not Naomi's decision to move. Although we did note there is a view that Naomi was considered complicit in this, based on Medrash in Rut Zuta, so there is that possibility. And I was actually discussing this with somebody yesterday, and he pointed out to me that if you look in the beginning of the Megillah, you find that after Elimelech dies, and after Mahlon and Kilion dies, right, in sentence 6, the text says that Naomi got up with her two daughters-in-law and returned from Moab, because she heard that Hashem had answered the Jews and given them bread. Meaning, the reason for her returning is not, well, now I'm able to return because Elimelech's done, because she didn't return after Elimelech's death. And it's not, Mahlon and Kilion are dead, and therefore I've decided, you know, it's really time for me to go back. It's because there's bread, which means that on some level she came to accept the idea of living in Moab. Even if the idea of leaving Israel was not her idea, she chose to stay in Moab until there was bread in Israel. Now, you could give all sorts of sort of layered reads of that. You know, you could say, for example, that she left knowing that the Jews in the land were not behaving well. Their conduct was not positive conduct. And when it says that she saw that God had answered us, it means that we were now worthy. So she says, oh, now that the Jews are worthy, now I'll go back and live there. I don't want to live among corrupt people. Maybe you could give that argument, but fundamentally it seems like she came to terms with living in Moab. That's really...
Rut Zuta,
I mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, is a smaller work of Medrash on Megillat Rut. There are a few books that have Zuta Midrashim, as opposed to Rabbah, when you see Bereshit Rabbah Shmot Rabbah, which means the larger bodies of Medrash. But as I think I mentioned when it came up previously, Rut Zuta may actually be an older body of Medrash in terms of its canonization than Rut Rabbah, which is the one that traditionally gets quoted. So it's a body of Medrash on Megillat Rut in a nutshell. But that was our first approach.
Do we know of any other Jews living in Moab?
No. There likely were. Jews lived east of the Jordan. You had those tribes that were living there. To think that there were Jews living among Moab, it would be stranger to think there weren't Jews living among Moab. I would think that there were. Our second approach was that what they did wrong was to abandon everybody who's struggling with this famine. And we had two approaches in that context. One approach was that they abandoned them for financial reasons. We don't want to support everybody because they do come across as being wealthy. They have fields. When Naomi comes back, everybody is shocked that she's come down from what she had been beforehand. And the other approach, which is brought in the Gemara, is that what they did wrong by abandoning people was that they didn't pray on behalf of everybody else. So we spent a lot of time on that last week. I'm not revisiting that right now, but we talked about Moav epitomizing selfishness in Tanakh, and so on. Our third approach, which we got into at the end last time, is that what they did wrong, and this is not to the exclusion of the other ideas, but that what was done wrong was that Mahlon and Kilion married non-Jewish women. They married women who were not Jews and were also not Canaanites. We talked about whether that would be biblically prohibited or rabbinically prohibited. We clarified the order of the marriages, right? We said that it was Kilion marrying Orpah first and then Mahlon marrying Ruth. And we discussed the question of whether it's true that there was no conversion. The basic way the Gemara seems to read it is that indeed there was no conversion beforehand. The Gemara talking about Ruth's speech as a conversion speech that she gives to Naomi certainly makes it seem like there had been no conversion beforehand. That's the standard view in the Medrash. It's supported also within the text itself, right? Consider that when Ruth and Orpah in chapter 1, sentence 10, say, we're going to return with you to your nation, El Amech, to your nation. They don't say to our nation, they say to your nation. So that supports the idea that they had not converted to Judaism. We did note, though, that there are those who insist that they did convert first. Ibn Ezra took that view. He says it has to be so. He brings what he believes is proof from the text as well. And as Chana noted at the end last time, Dr. Yael Ziegler points out that there is an idea found in the Zohar Chadash to root. Zohar Chadash, just to explain, is Zohar, meaning when the Zohar was first printed, not first came to light, but when it was first printed with a printing press, there were some manuscripts of parts of the Zohar that were not available to the people who were printing it. So those were only printed later on, even though they seem to be part of core Zohar material. So that becomes known as Zohar Chadash, new Zohar, when it's printed. So Dr. Ziegler points out that there is something in Zohar Chadash to suggest they had done some kind of a pro forma conversion initially, when they married Mahlon and Kilion, and so there had been some level of a conversion. Of course, the big problem that you have when you say that they had done some form of conversion before is, if that's really true, then is it right for Naomi to say to them, you stay in Moab? Right? I mean, they're Jewish. Why are you telling them to stay behind? That's not nice. That to me makes it very difficult to accept the idea that there was a conversion. But what I want to do now is, first of all, look at one last possibility for what the sin of the family was, and really Mahlon and Kilion. I want to make one note about this family that starts Megillat Rut, and then move on to talk about Orpah, as well as Naomi's pushing away of Ruth and Orpah. Those are the things that I'd like to get to today.
Hello?
Yes, hi, Ruchama.
Hey, I missed the other one, so maybe you spoke about it. But the fact that they left Israel when it was Rahab, they were not the first one. Abraham.
Right, so that was... Thank you. So that was something that we discussed. If you can, in every email that I send out for the class, I send out the links so you can catch the past recordings. So, yeah, I don't want to cut you off, but we did deal with it, and there's so much to get to today that I'm going to,
Can I say something?
Sure, Ricky.
What would have happened when Elimelech left all his fields and everything? Does that mean they were taken over, or does that mean they...
So when we get to chapter 4, we'll have a discussion of it, but it looks like it's been abandoned. That's what it looks like.
I'm sorry, it looks like what?
It's been abandoned.
So can she reclaim them?
So, like I said, we're going to get there. I'm not there yet. Okay. So let's get moving on this. And I want to note, as always, that I thank Dana and Ilan Rubinstein for dedicating the series for the year. So the fourth view is, or the fourth possibility is, that their transgression was marrying not non-Jewish women, but marrying Moabite women specifically. And you can see it in the way the text emphasizes constantly that they are Moabites. It never says they're not Jewish. It continually says they're Moabites. Even after returning to Israel, Ruth is identified as the Moavi woman. That's the way that the text presents it. And the Medrash shows it as well. If you take a look at source number one, the Medrash in Rut Rabbah. Tani b'shem Rabbi Meir. It was taught in the name of Rabbi Meir. Lo girum v'lo hitbilu osam. They did not convert them. They didn't go to mikvah. Right? We've talked about this. V'lo haisa halacha lehischadesh. There was no halacha to be taught newly. V'lo hayuna enashin aleihem. And they were not punished for them because amoni v'lo amonit, moavi v'lo moavit. The prohibition is against male amon and moav, not female. So what the text says is, number one, that they were not converted, and number two, that there was an issue. There was no lesson to be taught newly, meaning they didn't know that a Moabite is permitted. However, they're not in violation because, in fact, Ruth was permitted. In fact, Arpa was permitted. In other words, the wording in this Medrash is very, very hard to parse. But I believe what the Medrash is saying is that essentially they were trying to transgress, or what they're doing should have been a transgression, but it happens to be that it wasn't a transgression. It happens to be that it was okay. You know, they imagine, and you don't have to imagine it because we're going to see the case in a moment, but imagine a case in which a person takes a hamburger thinking it's treif, and it's actually kosher. So that's what the Medrash is describing here as happening to Machlon and Kilion. They thought they were marrying somebody they weren't supposed to marry, but in fact they're permitted. Yes, Susan.
But don't, when we have plural, it's always masculine. But we mean everybody.
So I'm not going into the amoni velo mavi velo amoni mavi velo mavi at this stage. I think we did do it at once in a previous week, but you are correct that I would not have assumed that the prohibition was only males. That would not have been my assumption. So,
especially because the women are the ones that determine if somebody's a Jew, is a mother.
Right. So that's less germane in this piece because they're definitely Moabite in identity, whether they're male or female. The exemption is not females aren't Moabite. The exemption is that female Moabites aren't subject to the law. So that part of it doesn't have the same relevance. But here's my problem here. As noted in the Medrash, and as we're going to see in the Gemara in Yevamos when it tells this story, also a Gemara in Ksuvos, Boaz is going to need to gather 10 men together in order to teach a lesson, the Medrash is going to say, that everybody should know that Ruth is permitted, that the prohibition against Moabites is only the males, not the females. So Boaz is going to get married to her in front of 10 people and make sure everybody knows. So that means, and that's what this Medrash is saying, that Machlon and Kilion are not aware that they are permitted, right? Just like I just spelled out. So why shouldn't they be liable for trying to transgress? Take a look at source number two. The source number two is our precedent for this. The Gemara there is talking about Hataras Nidarim, repealing a vow. And the idea that a man who marries a woman takes on certain responsibilities for her. However, he also gains certain rights in exchange for those responsibilities. So one of the rights that he gains is that if she takes a vow that would harm him, if she takes a vow that would cause him some kind of detriment, he's able to repeal the vow. That's the rule. Like it, don't like it, it's a great discussion for another time, but that's what the Torah says. And the wording in the Torah is that the man repeals the vow and then God will forgive her. So the Talmud is bothered by that. What do you mean? What's there to be forgiven? The vow is repealed. She hasn't done anything wrong. So it gives the following case. The case in which the husband repeals the vow without her knowing. She then violates the vow, thinking that she's breaking the vow. And what the text says is, but God will forgive her for that. And so you get this passage in source number 2, which I'm going to read in my English translation as opposed to reading it in the Hebrew just for clarity. Our sages taught, her husband annulled the vows, and God will forgive her. That's the biblical text. The text speaks of a woman whose husband nullified for her without her knowledge. And yet it says that she needs atonement and forgiveness. Why should she need forgiveness? The answer is because there's something wrong with thinking you're sinning, even if you're not. And when Rabbi Akiva arrived at this verse, he would cry. Someone who intended to take pork and instead a lamb came to hand still needs atonement and forgiveness. Someone tried to eat treif and accidentally ate kosher, so they need atonement. How much more so, one who intended to eat treif and actually ate treif. So in other words, there is some level of liability for trying to transgress, even if you did not succeed. And therefore, Machlon and Kilyon have liability, even though they were permitted. You follow? That's what we're saying. And so what I'm drawing out here is that that there is liability. And so this is another way to look at what they did wrong. Now,
it's in the Kavanah.
Correct. And the book is going to stress repeatedly the marriage to Moabites. When they get back into Israel, everyone is going to call Ruth a Moabite. It's really something that I think jumps out at you as you read it. Yes, Susan.
They weren't trying, Father's sake. They were living in Moab. We don't know the number of Jews there. It could have been. They met these. I don't think they were trying to transgress. It just sort of happened. They wanted to get married. They didn't. They weren't living in Israel. Maybe they should have waited. But trying means that they are purposely picked out of all the women they could pick.
So to me, that's a matter of semantics. If you don't like the word trying, you can substitute a different word. But they made a decision to marry Moabite women. Right? Whether it's letay avon or lahach is out of appetite and desire or because they want to get back at God, we're not given any indication in the text. But the point is, they did something that we know to be wrong. Toby.
I just want to respond to your question. You asked why we don't punish them. And I would suggest that it's because, doing something that requires atonement is not the same as doing something that requires punishment.
Correct.
They didn't actually commit a sin.
Right. No, I didn't mean to put it that way. Thank you for making that point. I didn't mean to suggest that, you know, Beis Din should be doing something. No, I agree with that. There's no grounds for that. A person who tried to steal and didn't succeed in stealing does not pay for theft. We do have one case where a person has liability for trying to sin and not succeeding, and that's what's called Edim Zomimin. People who come testify in court against somebody else trying to incriminate someone for something they didn't do will have to pay for that attempt even when they don't succeed. But that's a whole other thing. The last note I wanted to give on this before we move on from Elimelech's family is there's a really interesting contrast of families. Interesting to me. In the two books, it's three, but two that are relevant here, two books that are authored by Shmuel. Meaning, Sefer Shmuel starts out with a family. Who is the family in Sefer Shmuel?
Elkanah.
Right. Elkanah, Chana, and Pnina. Right? Elkanah is portrayed as righteous. Chana is portrayed as righteous. Pnina, a little problematic. In terms of her relationship with Chana, there's much discussion about that. Rabbinically, we look at Elkanah as a leading figure in his day, influencing other people to come to the Mishkan at Shiloh. And they are rewarded with a child who, of course, is Shmuel. So you have a leading family, husband, two wives, at least the husband and one wife are considered to be very righteous, helping people to come to the Mishkan, and they get a child. Then Sefer Shmuel has another family, shortly after the first one, and that is Eli, Kohen Gadol and Shofet, along with Hophni and Pinchas. We don't know anything about Eli's wife. Eli at this stage in the story is 98 years old, and so it's entirely possible that his wife had passed away earlier. We don't know. But Eli is certainly a leading figure. He is righteous. His sons, Hophni and Pinchas, are decidedly not. They're described terribly in Shmuel. And Hophni and Pinchas die, as does Eli. And now here, Mysh, I see you. And now here, you have roots starting out with Elimelech, Naomi, and their sons. The names of the fathers in the families, right? I mean, Eli is really different. Eli sounds similar, but it's a different name altogether. It's an ayin. But Elimelech, right? Elimelech, my God is king. Elkanah, God is the creator, owner of all. Chana, chen, favor, grace, charm, and so on. Naomi, ni'imut, pleasantness. There's an appeal to Naomi and to Chana. Elimelech also, Elimelech and Elkanah are similar. And Elimelech and Elkanah are both portrayed as leading figures. But Elimelech moves the family away, and Elimelech, Machlon, and Kilion die. Elkanah remains loyal, and he and Chana are rewarded with a son. I just think there's something to be said here about these Sfarim that are created by Shmuel. Yeah, created is the wrong word. Recorded by Shmuel. You follow? I don't know. It might be a bit of a reach, but I don't think it is. I think there's something to be said here. And speaking of something to be said, Moish, what do you got?
I'm surprised you didn't say reach. But this is an incredible reach. I'm going to solve for you right now the marriage of Machlon and Chilion.
Okay.
Take that story, move it forward 3,000 years, and it's obvious. Anybody who marries in North America through Reform and Conservative has to remarry in Israel.
Moish, I'm gonna stay away from this one. Do you mind?
Why? No, seriously. Why doesn't it make sense that there were relaxed rules?
Moish, I'm gonna stay away from it because it's not gonna advance my understanding of Megillat Rut. That's why.
Of what?
It's not gonna advance my understanding of Rut.
But it's the same thing because you see there was a conflict going over these things.
I'm going to leave that one be, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay. So, that brings me to ARPA. And Moish actually wrote me an email right before this class, lionizing ARPA. So he's going to appreciate this. If I had to evaluate ARPA based on the text, the way ARPA is presented in the Sefer, without knowing anything else, without doing any great examination, how would you view ARPA?
Nothing wrong with ARPA from the text.
Nothing wrong? Sorry, Toby, what?
Obedient.
Obedient? Hey, because she actually left when Naomi told her to.
That's really all we know about her.
Well, that she wanted to go in the first place is a good thing, right? I mean, that's viewed in of itself as a chesed. Sorry, what, Rose?
We don't see her in a negative light, but not as positive, obviously, as Ruth, because she went back. And although she was ordered to go back, that was her people. So she chose to stay with her people. I mean, nothing wrong.
Certainly nothing wrong, but I'd argue even positive. Meaning, if you wanted to argue that there's something wrong because ARPA married Kilion, then you should argue that Ruth is wrong for marrying Machlon. Right? I mean, it's not really fair. You could argue based on something we said from Malbim previously, but basically it's the same thing. Yes, Debbie?
I don't think that Ruth wanted either of them
Naomi did not. Naomi wanted neither of them.
And she didn't want them. They were not.
Oh, we're going to get to... Right. We're going to get to why. We're going to get to why Naomi doesn't want them.
Because they weren't acceptable, you know.
Hang in there.
Okay.
Goodbye. Hang in there. No, I will bring sources that agree with you. I'm just not there yet. So, Orpah seems like she's okay. And if Ruth gets credit for staying with Naomi and walking back with her, Orpah does seem to get some credit for her intentions. Take a look, please, at source number 4. Gemara in Sota. It's echoed also in a Medrash in Rut Rabba, but I just brought you the Gemara in Sota. Oh, I see where I did it. Okay. It's the second half of source number 4. I'm not ready for the first half yet. I brought you the whole source together. The second half where it starts, oh, you know what? No, you do need the whole thing. Otherwise, it won't make any sense. So I'm going to explain it outside, and then you'll see. The Tanakh in source number 5, which we're not up to yet, is going to tell us about 4 great warriors who fought against the Jews and were defeated by King David's men. One of them is very familiar. His name is Goliath. And these 4 are described as the descendants of Harapha. The Gemara is going to assume that Harapha equals Orpah. We'll talk more about that. I'm not leaving that alone, but right now that's what you need to know. And so the Gemara says that these 4 fearsome people are sons of or descendants of Orpah. In one of them, again, being Goliath. So take a look at source number 4. The Gemara, and again, I'm going to do my English just because it's a long text. The Gemara says, it is written, Harapha, and we're going to see that, and it is written, Orpah. In the story in Ruth, it's written, Orpah, and the Gemara assumes they're the same person. So Rav and Shmuel once said her name was actually Harapha. And why was she called Orpah? And it gives this whole explanation, which is terrible, about Orpah. And Susan remembers when we did this in Shmuel, and remembers that there also I did not say what the Gemara says about it. If anyone wants to look at the Gemara, they are free to do so, but it's pretty harsh. And then the other one says, no, her name was really Orpah. Why was she called Harapha? And it also gives a very harsh, negative explanation about Orpah. And then it continues to say, these 4, the 4 warriors, were born to Harapha in Gat, and they fell into the hand of David and into the hand of his servants. Who were they? Who are these 4? Rav Chisda said, Saf, Madon, Goliath, and Yishbi Benov. And they fell into the hand of David, into the hands of his servants, for it is written, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, and Ruth clung to her. David defeats Goliath because Ruth stayed when Orpah did not. And then you get, Rabbi Yitzchak said, God said, let the descendants of the kissed one fall into the hand of the descendants of the clinging one. The one who stayed defeats the one who simply had this kiss with Naomi. And then you get to the line that I wanted to get to. Rava said, as a reward for the 4 tears Orpah cried for her mother-in-law, she merited, and 4 warriors came from her, as it says. They raised their voices and they cried further. So, leave aside everything until that last line first. We're going to come back to the rest of it. The point is, and what I'm trying to show you is, that the Gemara, as well as the Medrash in Rut Rabba, say that she's rewarded, Orpah's rewarded for her tears. So, and she is the one who obeys Naomi, as Toby noted. So far, skipping most of that Gemara in Sota, so far, Orpah is good. We like Orpah. She listened to Naomi, she wanted to go back with her, but she didn't go back with her. Why in the world, does the Gemara at the same time villainize her? Susan, I see your hand, but I want to go through this. How are we to understand the Gemara's portrayal. When the part that I skipped, which interprets the meaning of the word arpa, and the part that I skipped that interprets the meaning of the word harafa, are very, very harsh. They speak basically about immoral sexual relations that arpa slash harafa goes through that produce these four giants. It's all based on source number 5. Source number 5 from Shmuel Bet tells us about those four warriors who were descendants of Harapha. So you see, again, war broke out between the Philistines and Israel. David and the men with him went down and fought the Philistines. David grew weary. Ishbi Benov, one of the four, tried to kill David. He was a descendant of Harapha, the Rapha. His bronze spear weighed 300 shekel, which is very heavy, and he wore new armor. But Avishai, son of Tzruya, came to his aid. He attacked the Philistine and killed him. And at that point, David's men said, "We don't want you going into battle anymore because you could get killed if you go into battle." I was thinking about that just today when I saw the headline from Chad, right? The president of Chad was killed in frontline battles against the rebels. So I thought about them saying here, "David, we don't want you to go to war." And then you see that there's more, another war that breaks out, and Sibchai the Hushatai kills Saf, a descendant of, again, the Rapha. And then flipping on to the next page, there's more fighting with the Philistines at Gov, and Elchanan, son of Yar or Gim of Beit Lechem, kills Goliath. And how that works and is that David is a great discussion for another time. And again, they're fighting at Gat, and there was a giant of a man who had 6 fingers on each hand and 6 toes on each foot. 24 in all, in case you can't do the math. He too was descended from the Rapha. When he taunted Israel, Jonathan, the son of David's brother Shimei, killed him. In other words, David has a nephew named Yonatan. Those four were descended from the Rapha in Gat, and they fell by the hands of David and his men. So the big question they're wrestling with is, who is this Rapha who you keep stressing? So the easy answer was what Radak says and what I know Chana's about to say, which is Rephaim. Right?
Well, I wasn't going to say that.
Oh, it would be a good answer, though. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, I don't think so favorably of him, because what she's doing is Gat.
Oh, okay.
From Moab to Gat, she has to go to Eretz Israel. She was supposed to go back to Moab, not to go west.
Right. So I was going to get to that a little bit. I was going to get to that a little bit differently. So hang in there. But Radak says, quoting his father, that the literal read of this text is Rapha is Rifaim, which were known to be giants. It makes a lot more sense to say that Rapha means Rifaim. It's very strange, and this is where I'm going with this. It's very strange to make the Rapha association with Arpa, number one. Number two, she's in the wrong place. Gat is a Philistine city, as Chana just pointed out, all the way by the Mediterranean. Moab is east of the Jordan. Completely different ends of the land. Why would she have gone to Gat? So Chana says, maybe this supports the idea that she's something wrong with her, because look, she went to Israel and she even went all that way when she didn't go back with Naomi. She didn't do what Naomi told her to do. But my argument is, why would I believe that at all about Arpa? Why am I making an Arpa-Harapha connection in the first place? It's not like these appear side by side. It's so strange. And now we're using it to say, and she engaged in these immoral relations that produced Goliath. Like, what did you need that for? Susan, now. You're muted.
This is not really a reward, knowing that her 4 sons are going to get killed. I wouldn't call that a reward for any mother to watch her children die.
Well, I don't think that's predestined. Meaning, it's that she has these 4 mighty sons. They choose to go to war against the Jews. They choose to attack King David.
But it's a wrong generation. David and Goliath then are wrong. If Goliath is a son of Orba, then he can't also be fighting David, who is the...
Yeah. So, right, so the answer...
Oh, no, he's a descendant.
Hang on. That's why I said descendant before. You could work with descendant, although, frankly, once you're working with monster-sized giants, let them be also superannuated as well. That doesn't bother me so much. But I want to go in order here. I know Susan was still talking, and then Rose?
I just find the whole thing where they've taken Orpah from so many different places. Try to make her good, then they try to make her bad. And it's more sounds like they're trying to find a reason to make her fit this portrait of her, and then
yeah, no, this is why I'm asking the question. We're on the same page. We're both bothered by this. Rose.
Also look at the time frame. I mean, women didn't just have the opportunity to just go and take themselves and transplant themselves. Is it not possible that she was taken by someone in Moab, whatever, and she was transported against her will to Gut? I mean, that's very possible.
Theoretically?
Go around and do whatever they please. It just wasn't that way.
Theoretically? Could be. I have no evidence. Could be. So I wanna float an idea here. Yes, Sandra.
I just wanted to ask you, do we accept that Eglon was the father of both Ruth and Orpah?
There is such an idea that's brought in the Gemara that he's either their father or their grandfather. I think we mentioned it early on, like the first week, that that there are two different editions, one that he's their father, one that he's their grandfather, and that he's being rewarded because he stood up when Ehud ben Gera said to him, I have a message from God. He's rewarded by having these as his descendants. Yeah. Part of this is a rule I've mentioned before, the law of conservation of biblical personalities. You know, if someone shows up in one story, they're going to show up in five. But here's what I'd like to float. And those who are in my Shmuel Shir, I saw Alina here, and Susan and a few others who may have been there when I spoke about this. I think this Gemara that villainizes Orpah is not really about Orpah. It's about Goliath. That's really the idea. Meaning, those who learned Shmuel chapter 17 with me in the Thursday afternoon shiur will recall that chapter that describes the battle between David and Goliath is not really about the battle at all. The battle takes like three sentences out of 50 something. It's much more about identifying for us who David HaMelech is, who King David is. And it's framing the battle of David and Goliath as a battle of opposites. They're opposites in size. They're opposites in armor and weapons. They're, you know, Goliath is covered almost head to toe in metal plate. He's got these monster-sized weapons. David is given armor that he rejects. And he's given a weapon that he rejects, and instead he has a slingshot. They're opposites in invoking God. Goliath does not invoke God until at one point towards the end, where he blasphemes against the God of the Jews, whereas David goes out to battle saying God is going to take care of this. And we talked about this more, the opposition in the Shiur about Shmuel. But here, what I think it's trying to do is also paint an opposition in ancestry. We know David is from Ruth. That the text is going to tell us in the book of Ruth. And Ruth is righteous. If David is from Ruth, Goliath has to be from Orpah. It's an opposition. And just like Ruth is righteous, Orpah then must not be. It's creating an opposition that's meant to highlight for us David versus Goliath as an opposition. Which is why, hang on, one more note. Which is why the criticism in the Gemara in Sota, all of the negative language in the Gemara in Sota about Orpah, only focuses on one thing, which is the act of relations that produced Goliath. It doesn't say anything about her being a bad person. It doesn't say anything about her having done something inappropriate with Naomi. It doesn't say anything about her marriage to Kilion. None of that is mentioned there. The only thing that they have on Orpah is that she produced Goliath. Because that's really what the Gemara cares about, is to identify David, son of Ruth, as the opposite of Goliath, son of Orpah. That's all the Gemara is really going for. Yes, Susan.
If you remember, when we did that, my translation went into some detail about what the Gemara said.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between trying to make her the mother of Goliath and totally taking her to the lowest level of
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I read the Gemara.
Yes, no, you read it. I'm just saying I don't know the words to use. And I think they went too far. I don't think... It's still a name, and it's still in the Tanakh, and it's still someone we talk about. And to attribute such coarseness is overkill. It didn't mean...
What am I supposed to tell you? That's your reaction to it.
But
okay.
There's no proof of what they're saying.
No, because that's not what they're trying to do. This is not a midrash. We've talked about on other occasions the different kinds of midrash that are
yes.
there. This is not a midrash that's trying to present you with history. This is a midrash that's trying to present you with a lesson about David. That's really what its goal is.
About
Goliath, but only as a foil for David. They don't really care about Goliath.
Foil for Ruth. And Orpah's the foil for Ruth, so to
speak. In a sense, but not in that story, because the Gemara there doesn't talk about Ruth at all. It's really not focused on her. I have nothing to add, and we're not going to go further with it. It's just, this is what it is.
I missed the whole connection. How did they get Orpah to be the mother of Goliath?
Because we know the ancestry of David is Ruth, saying that Goliath then has to have an opposite in his ancestry. And the logical counterpart is going to be Orpah, and his mother's name, or his ancestress' name, is Harapha. So, Harapha, Orpah.
Maybe yes, maybe or not.
But that's what the Gemara is trying to do. Okay. Brief note now, as Chana.
I think that the immorality is exactly the opposite of food, like, Leviti Lechet Achara Bachurim, and she describes his established date Tznuah. So there's a lot to contrast here.
The immorality, I'm not sure I understand.
No,
you mean just putting it more opposite to Ruth. I see.
Yeah. Because she's described as...
Right. No, that's a fair point. So the Tzniut adds a layer in that Gemara's depiction of Orpah. I hear that. Okay. So the last part that I wanted to get to, we may finish this today, we may not, is the question of why Naomi refuses Rut and Orpah. And she refuses three times. If you look on your sheet in source number 6, I gave you the structure. The first time, chapter 1, sentence 8, she just gives this very generic kind of a refusal. She thanks them for their chesed. She asks God to reward them for their chesed with her. Right? They stayed with her after their husbands died. They wanted to escort her. And she kisses them. And they cry. And then they say, yeah, but we're actually staying. That's their response. If you look at Ruth, they said, Ki itach nashuv le'amech. We're gonna go back with you to your nation. As I noted before, your nation, supporting the idea that they had not converted at that point. Naomi then says to them more elaborately, no, you don't understand. You're not coming back with me. She says in sentence 11, Shovna v'nosai, lama selach noimi, go back, my daughters. Why would you go with me? Ha'oliva nimbamei, do I have more sons in me? Vayulachem la'anashim, such that you could marry them. Shovna v'nosai, leichna, go back, my daughters, go. Kizakanti miyos li'ish, I'm too old to marry. Ki amarti yesh li sikva, if I were to say that there's some hope for me. Gama yisi alayla le'ishra, gami alayla tivanim. Even if I had a husband right now, and I were to produce children, halahin tesaberna adasher yigdalu. What, you're going to wait for them to grow up? How long are you going to wait? The etymology of teagena is an interesting one that the commentaries all go through. It is not necessarily related to the word aguna, but look at the commentaries there. I didn't want to spend time on that right now. Albinosai, don't do it, my daughters. Ki marli me'od mikem. I'm so bitter. And the word mikem I'm going to hold off on. Ki yatzav v'yad Hashem. The hand of God has come out against me. So this elaborate three-verse rejection. And at that point, they cry in sentence 14. Arpa kisses her mother-in-law and leaves. And Ruth stays. At which point, Naomi tries again. Sentence 15. She says, look, Shava yivimtech alama ve'al Eloheha. Your co-wife there, not really co-wife. They were married to different people, but your sister-in-law. She already went back to her nation and her God. Shuvi achrei yivimtech, you should go follow her. At that point, Ruth gives her famous dramatic speech, don't push me to leave you. Where you go, where you stay, I stay, and we're going to come back to that one, but that'll be next week. So my question here is, what motivates Naomi to reject them and then to accept Ruth? So Devi has already given us one answer. She thinks that they are unseemly, these Moabite women. I'm going to come back to that idea. Others, any other ideas for why she rejects them? Why not just say, wow, this is so nice of you, right? You don't know how to say thank you for something.
She doesn't want to take responsibility for them.
She doesn't want responsibility? What kind of responsibility do you mean?
Does she have to feed them and house them?
Well, actually, Ruth ends up housing and not housing, but feeding her.
Right, but Naomi doesn't know that.
So in other words, it's just like, I can't take care of these women. Interesting. Okay, could be. Janine?
It might be embarrassing for her. She's coming back with two non-Jewish women, her daughters-in-law.
Right.
It would be much easier for her to come back alone.
Right.
She has to know what happened.
Right. I think that was Devi's idea as well, that these women are not going to pass in Beit Lechem. This is not, you know, what goes on in Moab stays in Moab. So we're going to come back to that idea. Susan.
Maybe she didn't want to add to the sin of marrying a Moabite. If she brings them back with her to Israel, they could very conceivably marry other Jews. And she doesn't want to be responsible for creating more of a sin if that was one of the reasons they were punished.
That's a very interesting concern. That's a very interesting. The concern is you bring them back, they marry a Jew. Okay. Rose.
Didn't we establish that it wasn't actually a sin? We've established that it actually isn't a sin to marry a woman, a Moabite woman. It's a sin to marry them.
Right, but two things. Number one, they don't know that. That has not been clarified and won't be clarified until chapter 4. That was our point about Mahlon and Kilio not knowing what they were doing was permitted. And number two, if they haven't converted, there is still a sin that we talked about last week. So you still have a problem on that front. So it's interesting. I haven't seen anyone suggest either that, you know, as Joyce said, that it's an issue of responsibility for them, or that it's an issue of if they get married, as Susan suggests, to somebody now in Beit Lechem, that's going to be her fault. I've seen three other ideas, one of which includes the idea that Devi and Janine put forth. The Malbim's approach is that Naomi simply feels bad for them. But also, what Malbim does that's of extreme value here is, he says, you have to read the Psukim more carefully in terms of what Naomi actually believes they're trying to do. In other words, no one at this stage has mentioned conversion, right? That's not something anyone has mentioned in the first two rounds. But also it's not so clear what they actually wanted to do. So Malbin says, if you look back at sentence 8, it just said they're accompanying her, right? If you look back at sentence 8, it said in sentence 7, it said they went on the road back to Judea, and Naomi said, you should go back already. She thinks that they're just planning on accompanying her to Yehuda and then going home. So she said, you've already done enough. You don't need to keep on walking me. Right? There's a mitzvah of Leviah. When you have a guest over in your house, God willing, end of COVID, we should be able to fulfill this. You have a guest over in your house. You're supposed to escort the guest out on the way home. But what happens? You leave the house, and they say, all right, enough already, enough already. You know, you can go back in. They don't really want you accompanying them that long. That's what Naomi's doing. Naomi is saying, thank you very much. It was a nice offer. Now go back. That's your first stage. Yes, Brona. You have to unmute. I don't hear you.
Naomi will go back with those two girls. It was Naomi's husband who committed the sin. He brought the family to Moab. But there's no, who did he think his boys were going to marry?
So, right, when we talked about last week, when we talked about the non-conversion, we asked the question of, so who is responsible? And we noted that really the responsibility begins with Elimelech for putting them in that position. That doesn't absolve them, but it does seem to start with Elimelech, and the Gemara said so. Right? The Gemara had actually, the Gemara in Bava Basra, I'm just flipping back through my notes, but it read that as being, you know, first Elimelech's fault and then theirs. But,
so does it mean that those boys should never marry because the father moved them there?
So I don't want to get into what is going to be a sensitive issue for people, but that would be the halachic recommendation, is that, yes, that they not marry. I realize that's a very difficult issue for a lot of people, and I'm not judging anything, but that's the, that is the halachic position. You know, I'm not really going back now to what they did wrong and the whole marriage issue, because I want to focus on why Naomi is rejecting them. So they wanted to accompany her to just to Yehuda. That's what it sounds like in the beginning. She tells them, go home. And then in sentence 10, the statement is, we're going to go back with you to your people. We plan to live in Beit Lechem. So take a look at the Malbim in source number 7. Gilu daitan she'ein hochen ita lelavosa at Eretz Yehuda v'lashuv misham l'Eretz Moav. They showed that their intent was not just to take the trip with her back to Judea and then go back to Moav. Ki itach nashuv le'ameich. We're going to go back with you to your nation. We plan to stay with your nation. She did not say to your God yet. Meaning to convert. Rak le'amech, to your nation. Rotzalomar lagur bein b'nei amech. The reason I included the Sikh is because she never actually says the Leilo Kayach, but neither here nor there. The point is, that wasn't my problem. My problem is it shouldn't say she, it should say they. That was my issue. They didn't say we want to go to your God. They said we want to go to your nation. Meaning, they have not expressed at this stage a desire to convert. That's the point. They had not yet said, we want to convert to Judaism. They said, we want to go back to live in your land. And on that, Naomi responds, continuing to the next line, Alzeh Amra Naomi Lehenat Sasa. So she gave them her advice. Shovna Benosai, Lama Telach Naomi, go back. Why would you go with me? Rotzalomar. Halo Bnei Ami Lo Yischatnu Imachem. You ain't going to find a husband in Beit Lechem. Moabites are not finding husbands in Beit Lechem. V'im tikvu sh'ani eschateini machem. Achar shekvar hayisen kalosai. And if you'll say, but you did, so maybe you'll marry off somebody to me. I don't have any more kids. There's nothing I can do. So, according to Malbim's read, what she's saying is, you can't live in my nation. It won't be good for you. To which then Orpah leaves, and she says, go back just like Orpah left. Take a look at sentence 8. Halo achar sheshava el ama shava gam ken el Eloheha. Once Orpah returned to her nation, she also returned to her gods. Kiloya daita li kanes bidas Yisrael, because she hadn't intended to become a Jew. Umistama gam at ken dateich, And Naomi is saying, I assume the same thing is true for you, Ruth. Just like Orpah went back home and is going to go be a good Moabite, that's what you should do too. She doesn't know that Ruth wants to convert. Which is why, with the third statement, Ruth says, no, I want to convert. Amech ami velokayech elokai. Your God is my God. Now, Malbim says, Naomi understands it's a desire to convert. Well, at that point, pushing her away would no longer be merciful. Ruth would have to remain a Moabite then. That's not good. So that's the idea, and this is supported by a medrash in Rut Rabbah. Remember that there was a word I didn't translate in the text. When Naomi says, Mar li mikem, right? She says, where was that, that sentence? She said, it's bitter for me, mikem, says the Medrash in source number 8, Marli Ma'od Mikem, Bishvilchem. It would be bitter for me, for you, on your behalf. Ki yatza bi ubevanayu bali yad Hashem, because God came out against me, against my sons, against my husband. I would feel like you would suffer as well if you came back with me. There's nothing for you here. You have nothing to gain. So Malbim says Naomi simply feels bad for them. That's one read. Second read is the Gemara in Yevamos. And the Gemara in Yevamos says no. This is about determining they're worthy of conversion. It's a rejection that is meant to test their sincerity. In other words, as this is read, we are actually looking at this as you want to convert? You want to join me? That's your request? We're not interested. In order to determine how they, you know, are they sincere? If you take a look at source 10, the Gemara in Yevamos talks about how you deal with somebody who wants to convert. It says, Ve'ein marbin olav, ve'ein medaktikin olav. In the context of how we try to make sure the person knows what they're getting into, and we say to them, like, you can't do this for the sake of benefit, we don't increase upon the candidate. The Prisha is a commentary to the Tur, which is a code of halacha, and he comments on this Ein Mar Bin Alav, that we don't increase, and it says, yeah, just like with Ruth, that when Ruth was insistent upon going with her, so then Naomi stopped trying to dissuade her. So we don't try forever, but we do try to dissuade, just like Naomi tried to dissuade them. She tried even three times, if you assume that all three times she knew that the attempt was to convert and not just to accompany her or to live there. So that's our second approach. Okay? Our first approach is she's rejecting them out of mercy for them. Our second approach is that it's because she wants to determine they're worthy of conversion. And then the third approach. And the third approach is Naomi does not want them. When she says, it's bitter for me because of you, it's stronger than what Devi and Janine said before. If you take a look at source number 12 from the Zohar Chadash, Ki tzar li me'od mikem, that's a mistake. It should say mar, but that's what the Zohar Chadash has. Aleichem miboyile. It should say, it's bitter for me upon you. And he gives you a pasuk like that in Shmuel. My mikem? What does it mean? It is bitter for me mikem. Mikem means it's bitter for me from you. Amar of Karunya, Amar of Bizna. Aku biliboy mikem. There is pain in my heart because of you. Deatun garamtun lebanai diamusu. You're the reason Machlon and Kilion are dead. Naomi says, every time I see you guys, I realize that that's what cost me Machlon and Kilion. I don't want you guys coming back with me. Stay in Moav. That's the way that, the Zohar Chadash reads this, and, Dr. Ziegler brings this idea. And she also brings the Medrash in Rut Zuta, in source number 13, which says what Devi and Janine said, Mibnei ma haisa machzeres osan, why was she turning them back? Kedei shalo tisbayesh bahen, so that she will not be embarrassed because of them. That's the idea. It's already 2:30, so I'm going to pause that there because there's one more piece from Dr. Ziegler where she tries to support this that I want to bring next time. But those are ideas for why she turns them back, out of mercy, or to determine sincerity for conversion, or because she really doesn't want them. And there's one more piece to that, that God willing we'll start with next time, and then what I want to do next time is look at Ruth's statement of conversion. Why does Ruth say the way that she does? What is it that we're supposed to draw from this? Before we continue into Perek Bet, into chapter 2, and we get to meet Boaz. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.